Thank you, Jeanette, for the welcome to country, this beautiful country. Thanks, Michael, for the introduction. It's always good to be at the annual conference of this society, one of the healthiest, maybe the healthiest of the professional organisations of our profession in Australia, with a long, proud history of involvement in the analysis of issues in the, first the agriculture, then the agriculture and resource sectors, going back half a century. My own contact with the issue that's the subject of my paper today became substantial through my role as chairman of the International Food Policy Research Institute. IFPRI, a few years ago, started to do some work on the global impact of climate change, and it quickly became clear, even to someone who'd only been at the margins of these issues, like I had been, that this was a central issue for global agriculture. My attention was caught by the fact that early analysis showed that the three parts of the world whose agricultural sectors would be most damaged by climate change were three parts that, for different reasons, I cared quite a lot about. So those three regions were the Indian subcontinent, home of regrettably, a very high proportion of the world's people, sub-Saharan Africa, where the world faces its greatest development challenge, and Australia, whose 21 million people don't matter a lot, don't figure much in the thinking of lots of the rest of the world's 6 billion people, but I think about them a fair bit. That started to get me professionally interested in the subject, but my deep involvement didn't really begin until I was given the commission to prepare the Gano Climate Change Review by all of the state premiers of Australia and chief ministers, with support from the then leader of the opposition, Kevin Rudd, and with a commitment that it would become a joint state and federal project if he became Prime Minister. The mainstream science and standard economic analysis together tell us that the Australian agricultural and resource industries are likely to be affected profoundly by climate change and by the global response to it. They are likely to be affected profoundly whether or not there is an effective global mitigation effort, and whatever the nature of Australia's contribution to that effort. The Australian economy and community as a whole, and the agricultural and resource sectors within the national economy, would maximise their prospect for future prosperity if there were comprehensive global mitigation, within which all significant economies were subject to quantitative emissions constraints, and trade in emissions entitlements introduced similar costs of abatement at the margin across all substantial economic activities in all substantial economies. Now, we know that this is easier said than done. The building of a comprehensive global agreement has required some countries to move ahead of others, and national mitigation regimes will be operating in an ad hoc world for some time. There are immense challenges to efficient global and national resource allocation, to effective operation of a multilateral trading system, and to public policy integrity more generally in the ad hoc world that accompanies the movement to greenhouse gas mitigation in some countries and not others, and for some activities and not others. Today I will begin by summarising some conclusions of my review on how the Australian agricultural and resource industries are likely to be affected by climate change and its mitigation. I will then focus on one important and difficult issue. This issue is the application of policies to support trade-exposed emissions-intensive industries prior to the application of a comprehensive global agreement and similar emissions pricing in all substantial economies. When I addressed this conference of the Society 3 years ago, I drew attention to the implications for the resources sector of sustained rapid economic growth in the large developing countries, first of all China. I was later to describe the phenomenon of sustained rapid economic growth in the early 21st century as the Platinum Age. In the early 21st century, the beneficent processes of rapid modern economic growth were entrenched in the populous countries of Asia, most importantly China, but also India and other large countries of South and Southeast Asia. In the third quarter of the 20th century, sustained rapid economic growth had spread beyond its places of origin in Western Europe and its overseas offshoots in North America and Australasia, and beyond the special case of Japan, into a number of smaller economies in East Asia. The large economies of Asia had established the necessary conditions for modern economic growth in the last quarter of last century. China from 1978, Indonesia from the mid-1980s, India from 1991. In some early years of this century, one might now say, in the years leading up to the great crash of 2008, modern economic growth on a global scale had reached its apogee. A higher proportion of the world's population was participating in sustained rapid growth in productivity and incomes than ever before. Rapid global growth in the Platinum Age was highly intensive in use of metals and energy. This was because growth was concentrated in countries at stages of development in which increased economic activity used metals and energy intensively. Supplying rapidly growing global demand would require continuing expansion of productive capacity in the resources industries. Prices and expectations of prices would need to remain high enough to induce the necessary investment. For a considerable period, real prices of metals and energy would need to remain well above the average levels of the last quarter of the 20th century. In this, the Platinum Age of the early 21st century would be like two earlier periods of strong global economic expansion, the late 19th century into the early 20th up to the First World War, and the Golden Age after the Second World War up to the cessation of rapid growth in Japan in 1974. I noted 3 years ago that most resource prices were then as high as would be necessary to induce the required increases in supply on a continuing basis. Market prices were to go much higher in the subsequent 2.5 years. This was because markets had not anticipated the China boom in particular and global Platinum Age growth in general, and there was concern about the short-term adequacy of supply capacity. The markets would have caught up, even without a great crash. After a lag, supplies would have expanded more rapidly and prices would have eased, although prices would have needed to remain at levels that were on average substantially higher than in the late 20th century. The resources boom that grew from the Platinum Age raised Australia's terms of trade to exceptional levels. It added about 12% to average Australian incomes in the 4 or 5 years to the peak of export prices in the middle of 2008. By 2008, the investment in new capacity was making a large additional contribution to Australian incomes beyond the lift from the terms of trade. High levels of investment were set to expand global production and to bring resources prices back to historically high but more moderate levels before the global financial crisis precipitated the great crash in global economic activity from the third quarter of 2008. The Climate Change Review discusses how the resources boom was the other side of the coin to an acceleration of growth in global greenhouse gas emissions in the early 21st century. Sustained rapid growth in the Asian developing countries, especially but not only in China, meant that global growth, the energy intensity of that growth and the emissions intensity of energy use were all much higher than in the most widely used scenarios applied by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the Stern Review. This at once made mitigation more urgent and important, and more difficult and expensive. I presented the final report of the Gano Climate Change Review to the Prime Minister of Australia on the morning of the largest one-day points fall on the New York Stock Exchange in history. The global financial crisis has provided the context for all of the discussion of the final report and of the government's white paper on a carbon pollution reduction scheme. The crisis and associated global recession has affected perceptions of what is possible in relation to mitigation in the near term. It has, for a time, stopped the rapid growth in emissions of the early 21st century. Since mid-2008, emissions from the developed countries as a whole and from China have been falling. It is a matter of great importance for climate change policy whether the global financial crisis represents a temporary pause in the Platinum Age or brings it to an end. My address to the CSIRO conference, Greenhouse 2009, in Perth next month, will focus on the implications of the global financial crisis for the global mitigation task and for the political economy of mitigation in Australia and abroad. For this paper, I will simply assert a conclusion that the current crisis may shift the trajectories of business as usual emissions growth by perhaps 2 or 3 years, but is unlikely significantly to affect the slope of the curve in subsequent years. For the climate change cognoscenti, it may bring down business as usual emissions in 2030 and later years to a bit below the levels that the review thought to be most likely. It may bring them close to the highest of the wide range of scenarios generated by the IPC. It may bring it close to the IPC's A1FI scenario, thought and often described as being extreme. It happens that the A1FI scenario and its implications for climate and for human activity was the basis for the review's modelling of the costs of climate change and the benefits of mitigation. So from the point of view of the credibility of our modelling, a few years' pause of emissions is likely to bring the trajectory of emissions growth back into what we had assumed for the future in the modelling. It is an implication of this view of the future of the Platinum Age that Australia can look forward to long-term average export prices for minerals, energy and metals considerably above the levels of the late 20th century, although below the levels at the heights of the recent boom. The global financial crisis gives us a little breathing space, but mitigation of climate change remains urgent and of central importance. We will need the breathing space, and we will need to use it well if there is to be a mitigation outcome that future generations of Australians and others judge to have been satisfactory. The Climate Change Review sought to assess whether it was worthwhile for Australia to participate in a global mitigation effort within which it would be required to play its full proportionate part. It also examined the extent of global mitigation, with Australia playing its proportionate part, that was best for Australia. The questions are different from, and as it turns out, much more complex than, the question underlying other large quantitative studies, whether the benefits of mitigation would exceed the cost for the world as a whole. Comparing global costs and benefits of mitigation have been the focus of the modelling work of Stern, of Klein, and of Nordhaus. All systematic studies of the costs and benefits of climate change mitigation must come to grips with some difficult conceptual issues. First of all, the costs of climate change mitigation, but only some of the benefits, and the benefits of mitigation come through reduced costs of climate change, are amenable to quantification using standard economic methodologies. The costs of mitigation come early and the benefits of reduced climate change late, so that an appropriate social discount rate must be used to convert values at widely different points of time into present values. And chapter one of the review goes into those conceptual issues and lays out the framework that we adopted. Intertemporal comparison of cash flows, dealing with the problem of the cost of mitigation coming early and the benefits late, the review found that the range of appropriate social discount rates for converting future into present values included the appropriate market discount rates for sovereign debt in a developed country. the conclusions about whether mitigation advanced Australian interests and about the degree of mitigation that advanced Australian interests, most of all, were robust across the range of appropriate discount rates. The analysis revealed that Australia was the most vulnerable of the developed countries to unmitigated climate change. Of all the developed countries, Australia would seem to have the greatest interest in early and strong mitigation. It follows by implication that the best level of global mitigation for Australia is the highest level to which the international community can agree. For any given extent of Australian mitigation, the costs are much lower if mitigation is undertaken within a global regime than through unilateral action. There is negligible climate change benefit from Australia acting alone, so any unilateral action should be transitional, temporary, and directed at developing an effective global agreement. The formal modelling of quantifiable impact suggests that through the first half of this century, strong global action directed at greenhouse gas concentrations of 550 parts per million, with Australia playing its full proportionate part, would reduce growth in the value of Australian incomes by a bit of 0.1% per annum. This loss would be expected to be restored in present value terms through the second half of the century. The additional benefits of mitigation, the possibilities away from the median of the income distribution, and the non-market effects, together with conventional market effects beyond the modelling horizons to the end of the century, tip the balance strongly in favour of mitigation. The same lines of analysis indicate that Australia's national interests would be served by the strongest feasible global mitigation. For example, a global mitigation effort directed at holding concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere to 450 parts per million rather than 550 parts per million. For 450 parts per million, the costs of mitigation are higher than for 550 parts per million, but these higher costs are amply justified by larger benefits of reduced climate change. A considerable part of Australia's vulnerability to climate change is concentrated in the resource and agricultural industries. The vulnerability of agriculture derives mainly from supply-side effects. Much of Australian agriculture operates close to the upper margins of the temperature ranges at which agriculture is undertaken successfully and close to the lower margins of the range of access to water. Higher temperatures threaten output directly in many areas and for many crops. Higher temperature also increases evaporation and reduces runoff, and so reduces access to moisture. In the conditions of southern Australia, runoff declines by around 15% for each percentage point rise in temperature. In addition, climate change is expected to be associated with major changes in rainfall patterns, which are likely to be unfavourable to Australian agricultural production. The vulnerability of the resource industries to climate change derives mainly from different considerations. And by resource industries, I'm using the popular concept of minerals and energy rather than natural resources more broadly. Higher temperatures and intensification of extreme weather events raise the cost of capital items to the resource industries. However, the largest effects operate through global demand and prices for resource-based products. Unmitigated climate change would slow growth in countries, notably the large Asian economies, which account for a large and growing proportion of global minerals and energy demand. Lower growth in these countries and in the world as a whole would reduce Australian export prices. Incidentally, the largest single loser through these terms of trade effects of unmitigated climate change is the coal industry. Coal exports are also highly vulnerable to distorted mitigation policies in coal-using countries. The resource industries in general, and none more than coal, have a powerful interest in effective global mitigation through processes that are built around comprehensive and similar emissions pricing across industries and countries. The agricultural and forestry industries, viewed broadly to encompass land use in general, have large potential for relatively low-cost sequestration of carbon emissions. They thus have considerable scope for generation of credits from any comprehensive regime of carbon accounting, which systematically rewards all sequestration and penalises all emissions. The review notes that the utilisation of this potential is potentially transformative for the mitigation task especially for Australia and its developing country neighbours, but also for the world as a whole. And I go over the potential for biosequestration in Australia in a fair bit of detail in Chapter 22. The numbers are not as final and hard as I would like. We need a lot more research in this area, but I think that by drawing on research around Australia, I was able to demonstrate that potentially this is of huge importance. Of all the research issues, this is the one that can make the biggest difference to perceptions of the cost of mitigation in Australia, and also to opportunities for rural Australia. If agriculture, land use change and forestry are subject to similar incentives to economise on emissions as other major sectors of the economy, the generation of carbon credits will be a major source of income in rural Australia. The review suggested that Australia should favour comprehensive carbon accounting and the bringing to account of all emissions and sequestration within this sector in the global emissions regime. There are technical barriers to the development of comprehensive carbon accounting for use in domestic and global mitigation regimes. These issues should be the subject of a major research effort in which Australia has both strong interests and comparative advantage in research capacity. The agricultural and resource industries are currently highly emissions intensive. Once the two broad sectors are included in an emissions trading scheme, entities within them will be the locus of legal compliance for a high proportion of emissions. A distinction has to be drawn between the point of compliance with an emissions trading scheme, the incidence of the legal incidence of the scheme, and the point of economic incidence. They're not the same with an emissions trading scheme any more than they are the same for any piece of taxation. The point of economic incidence will lie with the entity within the economy that actually bears the cost of the emissions permit. The two points, the point of legal incidence and the point of economic incidence, are different to the extent that the entity required to surrender the permit is able to pass on the cost to purchasers of its goods and services. When output is not internationally tradable, as with electricity generation or supplies of fresh food into domestic markets, there will be considerable opportunity to pass on the costs of emissions permits to final users. In these circumstances, the emissions reducing effects of emissions pricing occur mainly through reductions in demand for the more expensive final product. As competitively priced low emission substitutes emerge over time, there will be progressively less opportunity for firms using emissions intensive processes to pass on costs, and substitution in supply provides more scope for abatement. Most of the output of the Australian agricultural and resource industries is sold onto international markets. There is limited scope for passing on increases in the cost of emissions permits to final users until such time as most competing production is subject to similar emissions constraints. If and when there is comparable carbon pricing in countries which are the location for competing production, the main constraint on the pass-through of costs will be the availability of substitutes produced through less emissions-intensive processes, so that when we've got a global regime with similar carbon constraints in all economies, then pricing within the world market will be determined much as pricing within the domestic market is determined for non-traded goods. There's been much discussion of whether and in what circumstances it is appropriate to compensate firms for the requirement to acquit emissions permits. There is no economic case for compensation where competitors are subject to comparable constraints on emissions. Sales into the domestic non-traded sector and into an international market after the general adoption of comparable emissions pricing. Where competitors are subject to comparable carbon constraints, the presence of carbon pricing will raise the capital value of some enterprises, those enterprises applying low emissions means of meeting consumer requirements, and it will lower the capital value of others, applying high emissions means of meeting consumer requirements. Such changes in asset values are part of the normal rise and fall of elements of a market economy. The changes in relative prices provide incentives for new patterns of production and consumption and drive the process of adjustment to lower carbon intensity. The case for compensating losers is no stronger than for compensating for any other change in policy, from taxation to interest rates to tariffs. Perhaps of closer relevance to the subject of this paper, the fall in asset values in some enterprises following the taxation of the emissions externality generates no stronger case for compensation than any other instance of government introducing measures to reduce the external costs of some activity, from discouraging tobacco smoking or the consumption of alcohol or unhealthy foods to controls on the use of asbestos. There are winners and losers from taxation of or controls on negative externalities, and the gains and losses are recognised as being part of the risk of business. Different issues arise when an emissions-intensive product is sold onto a competitive international market. There is an economic case for making payments to firms that cannot pass on increased costs associated with carbon pricing because competitors are not subject to comparable carbon constraints. It is, however, a more limited case than is supposed in most of the Australian public policy discussion. The valid case is closely analogous to the case for measures to restrict dumping of subsidised foreign production onto the local market. The economically valid concern arising out of firms operating in Australia facing more stringent carbon constraints than overseas competitors is not that some Australian firms may reduce their levels of production or investment. Some reduction in output of some products would occur in a world in which there was comprehensive carbon pricing on a comparable basis. The economically valid concern is that some Australian firms may reduce their levels of production and investment more than would have been the case if all competitors in other countries faced similar carbon constraints. The aluminium industry can illustrate the distinction between concern for contraction of production and investment and concern for excessive contraction. We all know that the smelting of aluminium uses electricity intensively. Electricity can be produced through high emissions processes at an extreme through the use of brown coal, or low emissions processes, for example, geothermal or hydroelectricity. Natural gas can be used to generate electricity with intermediate emissions intensity. Comprehensive global carbon pricing would provide incentives for production of aluminium based on coal to contract, and for production based on low emissions electricity generation to expand. The pressures for reducing the share of an emissions intensive producer, say Australia, in global production, does not depend on the absence of carbon pricing in competing countries. With comprehensive carbon pricing, with similar constraints being applied in all countries with potential for economic production of aluminium, there will be strong upward pressure on costs of high emissions production, but not on costs of low emissions production. If at the relevant margins there is sufficient potential capacity at competitive prices to produce aluminium from low emission sources of electricity, there may be little upward pressure on global aluminium prices as a result of the introduction of a price on emissions. On the other hand, if the potential for additional low emissions production of electricity for aluminium smelting falls well short of the industry's requirements, the increase in the aluminium price may reflect most or all of the effects of the emissions price on the cost of coal-based smelting. If with comprehensive carbon constraints the global aluminium price would have risen more or less in line with the cost of emissions permits in Australia, comprehensive carbon pricing would generate little or no contraction of Australian production or investment. However, if it were the case that comprehensive carbon constraints would have little effect on global aluminium prices, there would be considerable pressure for reduction in production. How metal prices would be affected by comprehensive carbon constraints is an empirical matter, which can be the subject of analysis using standard techniques. For aluminium, my guess is that analysis would show some tendency for upward pressure on prices as a result of comprehensive carbon constraints. These would weaken over time as production patterns adjusted to the possibility of greater use of renewable sources of power, This, in fact, is what the modelling of the review indicated. The effect on high emissions coal-based Australian production would probably be slight in the early years, but greater over time as established capacity reached the end of its economic life. Whether Australia remained a major aluminium smelter and exporter in the long term would depend on whether it was able to become a competitive source of relatively low emissions energy. Australia's low-cost potential for geosequestration, biosequestration, and a wide range of renewable energy sources introduces the possibility that it would be a competitive producer of energy-intensive products. The anticipation of comprehensive carbon pricing has led to the search for sites for aluminium smelting with large potential for generating electricity with low emissions. Examples include the establishment and then the progressive expansion of BHP Billiton's aluminium smelter in Mozambique and its studies of the hydroelectric potential of the Congo, Rio Tinto's purchase of the Elkin aluminium smelting capacity based on Quebec hydroelectricity resources, the emergence of Iceland as a major locus of aluminium smelting based on geothermal and hydroelectric power, and the interest that several global aluminium producers are taking in the hydroelectric potential of Papua New Guinea. Any tendency for comprehensive global pricing to inhibit investment in Australian aluminium smelting may turn out to be temporary. And I've been through the conditions under which that would turn out to be the case. A valid case for payments to trade-exposed industries arising out of differences in carbon constraints from those applying in our trade competitors is not established by evidence that the application of carbon pricing in Australia will lead to lower levels of production. Rather, the concern is that the world is on its way towards comprehensive carbon pricing, and the absence for the time being of carbon pricing in some countries may cause some firms to reduce their production too far, that is, beyond the level that would eventuate if and when competitor countries were subject to commensurate carbon constraints. If the more favourable treatment of one industry within a competitor's than in the home emissions regime were expected to be permanent, the Australian economy as a whole would do best if the overseas distortion were ignored and Australian trade specialisation adjusted to the set of international prices that emerge from the permanent set of distorted interventions. But it is not expected to be permanent, and that is part of the justification for transitional support for Australian production. So, ironically, the case that many businesses make that there is not and never will be comprehensive carbon pricing actually makes a case for not compensating trade-exposed industries. But they are not the circumstances we're in. We're working towards a comprehensive global regime in which there is a risk of downward adjustments in a production and investment being made now, which would be reversed economically as we move towards comprehensive carbon pricing. On this issue, we have a close parallel to the economically rational response to other countries' subsidisation of traded goods industries, and you all know Corden on trade and welfare, so I need not go through the economics of that. So under certain circumstances, there are environmental and economic reasons for establishing special arrangements for emissions-intensive industries that are trade-exposed. The Australian public policy discussion has proceeded on the basis that compensation is warranted because Australia is introducing an emissions trading scheme. This leads to a quite different focus and outcome to that which emerges from an economically rigorous approach. It leads to focus on removing part or all of the costs of emissions permits to trade-exposed industries if it can be demonstrated that some competing producers do not face comparable constraint. The political economy pressures on governments in these circumstances are dreadful, and they're discussed at some length in the review. The issue has the potential to corrupt public policy processes with implications beyond the emissions trading scheme and to destabilise public support for mitigation more generally. Internationally, it can have the effect of systematically excluding many of the most emissions-intensive industries from the emissions constraints that are required throughout the global economy if the risks of dangerous climate change are to be held to acceptable levels. The progressive exclusion of trade-exposed industries by arrangements that differ across countries makes the details of emissions trading schemes, rather than underlying comparative advantage, the determinant of competitive advantage in the resource industries. Australia has more to lose than any other developed country from an internationally fractured, unprincipled, and partial approach to dealing with trade-exposed industries. We are one of the world's largest exporters of many emissions-intensive tradable products, and proportionally to the size of the economy, easily the largest exporter of these products amongst developed countries. Clear rules based on sound principles are a necessary protection for countries that would do well on a level playing field. Behind the fog of differentiated arrangements for trade-exposed industries will emerge a range of protectionist interventions that will be especially damaging to Australia. The growth of protection behind the fog of differentiated arrangements for shielding trade-exposed industries will be especially tempting and costly, although deeply counterproductive, as many countries seek to find their ways out of deep recession in the period ahead. How can Australia provide support for trade-exposed industries where it is warranted while avoiding the risks of unprincipled arrangements? The immediacy of the problem requires a three-pronged approach. This is not a matter of choosing one or other of three prongs. Two of the options rely on international agreement. The third is a domestic arrangement that could pave the way for an international approach. The three options are, first, a comprehensive global agreement on mitigation under which all major emitters have national emissions limits. Trade in emissions entitlements will then establish similar carbon pricing in all economies, even if the limits on emissions are set much more stringently for some countries than for others. The second approach is sectoral climate change agreements for our most exposed industries that establish similar carbon constraints amongst major competitors for particular industries, and I've formed the view that there is a real possibility in some of the most important of the industries, including aluminium, for global sectoral arrangements. And the third prong is domestic assistance measures for our most trade-exposed industries that remove the effects of major competitors having failed for the time being to establish comparable carbon constraints. Not compensating for the fact that we've got carbon constraints, but compensating for the fact that other countries as yet have not. The representations from business on shielding trade-exposed industries tend to be predicated on the view that nothing is happening elsewhere in the world, nothing will happen elsewhere in the world, nothing done by Australia makes any difference to what happens elsewhere in the world. I think that all of these premises are wrong. A lot is happening on policy to reduce emissions in Europe, in China, in South Africa, in North America, in Japan, properly to bring these into account is one major challenge of an effective principled regime for assisting trade-exposed industries during a transitional period. The correct approach to provision of assistance is based on the following principle. For every unit of production, eligible firms receive a credit against their permit obligations equivalent to the uplift in world price for their product that would eventuate if our trading competitors had policies similar to our own. This formula is conceptually sound. Because it is based on a clear principle, it has defined limits, and so does not lend itself to unbounded negotiations and unbounded calls on the public finances. The clear limits to calls on the public finances that are associated with the principled approach to shielding trade-exposed industries holds open the prospects of funding high levels of public support for research, development and commercialization out of revenue from sale of permits. Substantial public support for innovation in the new technologies is an essential component of successful domestic mitigation policies as well as of an effective global mitigation agreement. The open-ended nature of fiscal commitments under the arrangements for assisting trade-exposed industries that have been implemented in Europe with increasing awareness of the costs and increasing determination to reduce the costs, and which have been the focus of most of the Australian discussion, including that within the Commonwealth's White Paper. These arrangements make public expenditure to support innovation dependent on appropriation of funds from outside the mitigation policy regime, because the rent value of the permits has in effect been given out to business. In the Australian case, given out in roughly equal proportions to as compensation to households and compensation for business. The case for compensation for low-income households is a valid one on income distribution grounds, and I discussed that at length in the review. The proposed principle is simple. It can be applied using standard approaches to modelling global markets that are familiar to economists, including to many working within the world's large resource companies. The proposed principle ensures that firms are encouraged to invest and to produce to levels that are sustainable in the context of a global agreement, but they are not required to bear the full cost of doing so until there is an agreement. It rewards firms that might be described as early movers, but does not penalise other producers. It encourages firms that invest successfully in applying low emissions processes and does not reward investment in lobbying. Whereas the European Union and Australian White Paper approach invites competitive protectionist responses amongst countries that are likely to escalate over time, the principled approach lends itself to stable international arrangements. It is easily and usefully reproduced in other countries. Indeed, it is a reasonable hope that one country's adoption of the approach would encourage its emulation by others. Two or more economies applying the approach and connected by trade and emissions permits, and therefore subject to a common carbon price, could share the analysis of prices and appropriate assistance payments. Unlike the input-based compensation approaches that have dominated the policy debate, this approach fully accounts for the policies of competitors now and as they evolve over time. In this sense, it is self-correcting. Payments at appropriate levels continue in full so long as other countries do not apply comparable carbon constraints. They are phased out automatically as constraints are imposed elsewhere, whether unilaterally through sectoral agreements or through comprehensive agreements. The formulation for calculating payments ensures undistorted price signals for Australian business from the commencement of the scheme. Firms face incentives that accurately reflect those that will emerge from sectoral and then global agreements. Australian businesses will only reduce domestic production if that is consistent with long-term comparative advantage in a world of full costing of carbon externalities. I draw attention to a box in Chapter 14, Section 5 that sets out in a series of diagrams the underlying economics of the approach. Because this is a new idea, it will need innovation in administration, and in the full version of the paper I discuss a number of the administrative requirements. I think that in practice the administrative requirements of such an approach would be a good deal simpler than the requirements of the arbitrary approach as it has been evolving in practice in Europe and here. So in all of these circumstances, what are the prospects for Australian agricultural resource industries in this environment of concern for climate change? Like the Australian economy as a whole, but especially so, the agricultural and resource industries would be big losers from unmitigated climate change. Like the economy as a whole, but more so, they would face significant costs that were not balanced by benefits in the early stage of an Australian mitigation regime. They would each fare much better within a comprehensive global regime of emissions constraints and have a powerful interest in rapid advancement towards such a world. Amongst much else, agreement on a comprehensive system of carbon pricing would remove the risk of ad hoc arrangements differing from country to country, leading to the proliferation of protectionist devices in the guise of compensation. In the meantime, the integrity of Australian policy processes, of Australian and international mitigation, and of the multilateral trading system all require the adoption of transitional assistance that compensates domestic producers for other countries not having comparable carbon prices, rather than for the home country placing a price on emissions. Such an approach has large advantages for Australia acting alone. It has much larger advantages for Australia and for the world if it is adopted in many countries. Thank you.
Thank you, Ross. He's reinforced to me the complexity of the issue, but provided a lot of logic and sanity to the debate. If we can continue some of that logic and sanity, I'm going to open it up to questions from the floor. We have about 15 minutes that Professor Garno will answer questions. We have a roving mic. We have up the back.
Morning. Julian Alston, UC Davis. I'm very interested in the compensation argument, and I've got three kind of questions about it. There's a legal one, a political economic one, and an economic one. I guess it sounds like I'm persuaded there's a political economic argument for compensation as a way of making something happen. I didn't hear a persuasive economic argument for it, and I've heard an argument just like it for years and years in the context of agriculture. I live in the US where I hear it pretty often. The justification for subsidies in the US is because the Europeans subsidise. And I used to hear it here, that there's justification for subsidising here because the others do. And it's essentially that's what you're saying, I think, is that the failure to remove subsidies elsewhere justifies subsidising here, and I find that the economics of that questionable. It was certainly questionable in agriculture, and we got rid of that argument. The legal question is whether it would be considered legal in the WTO. It seems to me that the first response to doing this would be for the Americans or somebody else to take you straight to court and sue you over it.
Thanks. Good questions. I thought I went with some care through the subsidies argument and said the fact that other countries subsidise if we thought the subsidies were going to be permanent would not make an economic case for any payments to domestic industries. The case arises from the fact that we are moving towards global arrangements The subsidy implicit in some countries not taxing carbon externalities is expected to be temporary. So if we undertook the costs of adjustment in our economy to a distorted set of relative prices, then we get our global regime and have to restructure industry again. That would involve economic cost. And I think there is an economic case for avoiding that. But you're quite right, and it's a point I made in the paper, the presence of subsidies in other countries does not make a case for subsidies here. And if, as many businesses are arguing, there is no prospect for other countries adopting comparable carbon constraints in the foreseeable future, then your case against any domestic assistance is a strong economic case. On the legal question, I hope that this does become a WTO issue. I'm afraid that it won't. because the political economy of this issue is going to promote a race to the bottom. Europe's got some distorted arrangements wherein we might be in the process, I hope we're not, but we might be in the process of introducing some distorted arrangements. If you look at the various bills that went before Congress for constraints on emissions in the last Congress, they all had tags associated with major assistance to some firms, and there were always conditions about what was to be done on imports from countries that didn't have comparable carbon pricing. So I'm afraid that the political economy will drive all countries towards more and more distortion rather than taking other countries to the WTO to get rid of distortions. To avoid all of that, to avoid a very damaging mess, to avoid a mess that could be as damaging after the great crash of 2008 as Smoot-Hawley was after the crash of 1929, it would be wise for us all to seek a WTO regime at an early stage, which placed rules and constraints around assistance to trade-exposed industries. I think the best basis for a WTO regime would be the principles that I've outlined in the review and in my paper today.
Yeah, John Quiggin, University of Queensland. Following that up, and particularly in the context of the WTO, the European Union is already talking about taxes on embodied carbon from non-complying imports, and you've mentioned that in the US. That would seem to be addressing the unfair trade practice directly, and so a couple of questions. One is how you view it, and the second is your view of how the WTO would be likely to handle direct implementation of sanctions on countries that don't comply.
Yeah. I'm very cautious about import duties on untaxed embodied carbon because if it was done unilaterally in each country, it would become a pathway to escalation of protectionist elements. I think that's the pathway on which the world is. And I think we're contributing to that with the sorts of proposals that are in the white paper. I think it will be highly damaging for the world economy. I would have a different view of it if we had an agreement within the WTO and clear rules, that could become one of the sources of pressure on countries that are not contributing, not participating fully in a global regime. And I discussed that in the review. But in the absence of a WTO framework, I think the downside risks are very large. But I think it's going to be difficult to avoid those risks anyway. Is the WTO up to it? I think that was the real question at the end. The WTO has had a bad period. The WTO and the gap between them had their time of greatest glory in the late 1990s and early 21st century. I think that Chinese membership of the WTO, the completion of the Uruguay round, a couple of the major multilateral sectoral agreements added up to a huge improvement in the global trading system. Just the development of the rules under which China on a very large scale would enter the global trading system was a huge achievement. There haven't been achievements since then. Bagwati's come out with a recent book, Termites in the System, describing how the proliferation of preferential trading agreements has undermined the WTO. We've had a period in which there hasn't been much interest in multilateral cooperation generally across the international system. I think it's very important that we rebuild that support for the multilateral system and make the WTO strong enough again to handle this issue, maybe in the new circumstances of awareness of the dangers of protection in a deep global recession. New leadership in the United States maybe we'll be up to it. If we're not, the downside's very large.
Catherine Smith from the Department of Climate Change. Professor Gano, thank you very much for your talk. Two questions about the agriculture in the CPRS. Firstly, I think it's probably fair to say that farmers are very concerned about the effects of agriculture on the CPRS, even before their eventual possible inclusion because of their input costs increasing. They, I think it's fair to say, disproportionately more than those of other industries. And secondly, the related concern that the conversion of agricultural to forestry land will affect them a lot as well. What would your comments to farmers be?
Well, I think with comprehensive emissions pricing, where we're giving full credits for all sequestration, as well as taxing output or taxing inputs that are emissions intensive, my assessment is the Australian agriculture would be a big winner out of that, or Australian land use industry more generally. And no Australian farmer will lose from the opportunity of growing more trees on her or his land if there are incentives within a global trading or an emissions trading regime. It may be that some agricultural land is converted to sequestration, growing trees, or in other ways. But within our market economy, with farmers having property rights in their farms, that will be raising the incomes of farmers. I think it is reasonable for the farm sector to be worried about the taxing of inputs if it's not accompanied by full credits for carbon sequestration. I think the potential for carbon sequestration in rural Australia is immense. As I said, potentially transformative of the mitigation task as well as for the rural economy of Australia. Just one last point. The emissions that are largest from the Australian agricultural sector are the methane emissions from ruminant animals, sheep and cattle. In a global emissions regime, if we have Europe, Japan, North America in the regime with us, then most of these industries, the livestock industries of the Northern Hemisphere, are more emissions intensive than in Australia, partly because you've got to keep animals warm in winter, and that generates a lot of emissions. You feed them grain in winter, and there's a lot of emissions input into grain. So this is a very clear example of where our farm sector might actually win out of everyone paying for inputs, but if they alone are paying for inputs and the Europeans develop a whole lot of arguments why farmers should be excluded, then obviously we're at a competitive disadvantage.
If I might add a question to that, you talked about the need for comprehensive accounting, but also some of the technical difficulties associated with accounting in this sector, particularly around biosequestration of soils.
I did. I'm not pessimistic about the administrative and accounting issues. My first recommendation would be that there should be a very big research effort knocking over the problems. And we're much closer to solutions than we were a few years ago. The use of remote sensing and indirect ways of measuring carbon in vegetation. With soils, there's a lot more work that needs to be done, but a lot of good work being done in Australia. And if we get it right for Australia, that's a major public good we've given to the world and a very important one. So I think the first thing we should do is hugely increase our research effort and knock over the problems, because I think we can. And Beth, I think, has got a question on a similar subject.
Hello. Lynn Seely from Land and Water Australia. I have at least two questions. The first one is on research, and it'll be short. If you had the top five topics that you would want to invest in research on climate change in Australia, what would they be? And the second one is soil carbon. The soil scientists that I've spoken to just dismiss it and say it will be too difficult to measure and account. There's a lot of push, obviously, for including it. But the first one is on research and the priorities for research to be able to knock off some of those issues.
I'll deal with the second one first. There are different views. There are good soil scientists who take a different view. There are problems. I think that we should deal with them because so much is at stake. There's a very big payoff for Australia and for the world sequestration arrangements, the world mitigation effort, if we can get that right. Top five research topics on climate change. Well, that's very big. For Australia, we need a bigger effort on what might one call the big climate science. There are things that are different about the climate of the Southern Hemisphere. At the moment, all of the world-scale efforts on climate science are being made in the Northern Hemisphere. We've got top people here. The recent expansion of the cooperative effort of the Bureau of Meteorology and CSIRO is greatly to be welcomed. But we don't yet have the capacity to bring the big computing power to account that the Hadley Centre, the other Northern Hemisphere systems have. I think we can contribute to a world effort through being expert in the climate of the Southern Hemisphere, but we also need that for adaptation. The knowledge of regional effects of climate change is nowhere near what it needs to be if we're going to make successful adaptive efforts, because we're too late to avoid very big changes in climate across Australia. So understanding where and how they're going to hit is very important. So I suppose I put number one, climate science. I would place very high on my list, I'll make it one area of research, the range of area of research related to measurement and maximisation of the value of sequestration in rural environments through modification of land use. And that's carbon in vegetation and carbon in the soils. I think that is the most important research task related to mitigation in Australia. I think there's a big opportunity for Australia in research on sequestration of emissions from our energy industries, rising out of, first, our very great interest in the world finding mitigative solutions to burning fossil fuels as the world's biggest coal exporter and big exporter of natural gas. We've got a very strong interest in the world finding solutions to that. We're starting to put a large effort into geosequestration. That's an area of Australian interest and comparative advantage, and we should expand that and take a global lead. But I'd bracket in that same research effort parallel work on related issues of biosequestration. I became aware through my review of some very clever work, some of it being done here at James Cook, on use of algae for biosequestration. There's clever work in by the CSIRO in South Australia, work at other universities around Australia. It's all at an early stage, but that is potentially a major source of sequestration of emissions from energy generation, combustion of fossil fuels, whether in generators or in steel mills. We've got comparative advantage in the biological sciences and a very strong interest in finding a solution, so that's a natural one for us. Because I've given such... Well, I'll add a fourth. I think we need to strengthen our research effort on climate policy, really the sorts of things that I was coming to grips with in the review, but on a continuing basis, bringing to account information coming from the science, further development of the modelling on impacts, continually reviewing implications of new knowledge for Australian policy. So you asked for five. I've given you four big ones.
Do we have one remaining burning question? We've got one down here, and then I'll have to wrap it up. Second row.
Yes, Axel Michael over University of Zurich. You stressed the role of biological sequestration. Now we all know that there is a permanence issue, and given the impacts of climate change, what we've seen in southern Australia the last few days, the risk, of course, of these sequestrations going up in smoke are severe. So what types of insurance or policy measures would you propose to deal with those risks?
Yeah, for individual owners of land, investing in biosequestration, there needs to be a system of insurance. I talk about those a little bit in the review, but I haven't done all the work that gives us the final answer on that, so I'll just say this is an important issue. I think it can be done. But very important for sequestration credits in developing countries in particular, with less national capacity for national governments to pay back sequestration credits if forests are destroyed by fire. In the case of developing countries, that very important case, I think we do need comprehensive carbon accounting within a national emissions limit to provide full incentives for optimal use of forest lands in developing countries. But you would need insurance systems to cover the contingencies you're talking about. I think you'd probably want to have as part of the regime the putting aside of a certain proportion of the credits to be held as an insurance fund. There's more chance of handling those issues through private insurance in the more developed insurance systems of the developed countries. Even fires on the scale of the horrific tragedy in Victoria over the last week, in the context of national mitigation, are probably such as could be handled by national private insurance systems. But that's a question, and it may be that public insurance systems will be required as a backup.
We're eating into coffee time. I must say, from a Land and Water Australia perspective, as Chair of the National Climate Change Strategy for Primary Industries and formerly with the CRC for Greenhouse Accounting, Professor Garnaut's words about research and the needs are music to my ears. I hope they're caught on tape, because I'll use them again and again and again. But thank you very much for your contribution today, your very significant contribution to the debate within Australia and internationally. Thank you, as I say, for bringing sanity to the discussions and clearly thought through logic. And thank you for taking the time to be with us here today on this, and addressing this very important subject.